So you just heard today's scripture passage read. It is probably my favorite resurrection story. It took place 3 days after Jesus' crucifixion on that first Easter Sunday. Two followers of Jesus, one named Cleopas, the other goes unnamed. These two disciples of Jesus had apparently joined Jesus in Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover, and there became eyewitnesses to the brutal death of Jesus, the crucifixion of Jesus. I mean, imagine the trauma of witnessing the death, the torturing to death of someone that you love. These two disciples apparently lived in the village of Emmaus, which was 7 miles from Jerusalem. And so now, 3 days later, they're walking back home to Emmaus. And as they're walking, they're trying to process all of this trauma. Verse 14 tells us they were talking about all these things that had happened concerning Jesus. And as they were walking, a stranger came along who overheard a part of their conversation and said to them, "What are you discussing with each other?" As you heard, the text tells us they stood still looking sad. Boy, that captures it, right? They were stuck in deep grief, deep sadness. And they said to this stranger, "Are you the only person in Jerusalem who doesn't know the things that have taken place there in these days?" And then they proceeded to tell this stranger about Jesus and how he had been crucified. And they added, "We had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel." It was then that this stranger began a long and passionate exposition of all of the Old Testament passages predicting that the Messiah had to suffer in order to, quote, enter into his glory. And as this stranger was expositing these scriptures, those two disciples felt something powerful happening inside of them. It's like they were being enlightened. It's like, yes, this makes sense. We understand so much better now. By the time they reached Emmaus, it was evening. And so they invited this stranger to lodge with them for the night. And that's when things started getting spooky. At the dinner table that evening, the stranger took bread, broke it, blessed it, and gave it to them in exactly the same way Jesus used to. I mean, it was uncanny. The mannerisms, what was said, how it was done, was exactly the way Jesus had done it. It was almost as if Jesus was right there with them. And that's when it hit them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him to be Jesus. It's Jesus. And he vanished from their sight. What an electric moment that must have been. Now, when we hear this story, the question that typically arises is, how could Jesus have been with them all day long and they didn't recognize him? Apparently, the answer is our resurrection bodies will look sufficiently different from our earthly bodies that they won't be immediately recognizable, which for many of us is good news, myself included. Someday, when you see me with my resurrection body, I'm finally going to be 6'5", have real muscles, and all kinds of curly, flowing hair, kind of like Fabio on the front of those old romance novels. You won't even recognize me when you see me in heaven. But I digress. Because that is not the main point of today's gospel story. The main point of today's story is that Jesus was right there with them in their grief, walking them through it, helping them process, helping them understand. Jesus was right there with them the entire day, and they did not recognize it. The lesson for us being, you are never alone. The power of the risen Christ is with you, whatever you experience, wherever you go, whether you can perceive it or not. So today, let's wrestle with the implications of that for us, what that means for us in our lives. This is the fourth installment in our sermon series about living with resurrection power. And we're going to do something a little unusual today. I'm going to walk us through four great Bible stories that you're probably quite familiar with, but we're going to weave them together in such a way that hopefully by the end of today's sermon, you might just say, aha, I never saw it that way before. It makes more sense. Now I better understand what it means to live a life of faith. We've already covered the first great story, Luke 24, three to go. Let's start with a prayer. Jesus, if you are here with us right now, in this very room, and if you're going to be present with us, each one of us, tomorrow, and the next day, and the next, through everything that we experience in life, if you are always present with us, that means that your power is also always present with us. We need that power. Show us how we can better tap into that power. That's our prayer. That's our question for today. Speak, Lord, we pray, in your holy name. Amen. There is a Southern artist whose paintings are commonly displayed in the Craft Village at Dollywood near Gatlinburg, Tennessee, where David and I, every Thanksgiving, spend a week vacationing in the Smoky Mountains. The trademark of this particular artist is he paints common, everyday scenes, things that you would experience on an ongoing basis in your everyday life, but embedded in every one of those paintings, subliminally, very subtly, somewhere in that painting, is a hidden presence of Jesus. When your eyes first rest on the picture, you don't see that, but if you let your eyes remain there long enough, eventually, in the shape of a cloud or in a shadow that is cast, you'll say, ah, there it is. Now I see the embedded image of Jesus. I love that artistic motif because it powerfully reminds us of the core message of Luke 24. There is so much about our reality, so much around us that we can be completely oblivious to. Take a look at this photograph of our living room at home and tell me if you notice anything unusual about this photograph, other than the fact that we still have Christmas decorations out, because for David, every day of the year is Christmas, so ignore that. But other than that, do you notice anything unusual about this photograph?
It looks like checkers.
It does look like checkers, but look really close at the bottom of the couch on the left. Do you see it? Here's a close-up. Little kitty paws are sticking out from beneath the couch. That's our cat, Gigi. She loves to sleep there because it's so warm. She thinks she's hiding. Not quite. You could spend all afternoon in that living room and never know she's there. But she is. There is so much in the world that surrounds us that we are oblivious to. When I take my dog Lucy for a walk, as we are walking, every 10 feet, I do not exaggerate, she finds a new smell to savor. So as we're walking along, I'm looking at the clouds and the sky and the beauty of nature. I'm communicating with creation via my eyes, but not my dog, Lucy. My dog, Lucy, has her nose to the ground, and she is all about the smells. She can smell things. Do you know that scientists say that the typical dog has a sense of smell that is at least 10,000 times greater than ours? So as we're walking along, she is smelling all of these smells. I know, as we're walking along, I am surrounded by a world of scent, of smell. But I'll walk up to right where she is. I'm oblivious. I can't smell it. It's there, but I can't detect it. There is so much in our reality that escapes us. Have you heard of the concept of dark energy and dark matter? It's called dark because scientists know it's there. They can measure its impact, but it cannot be perceived by us as human beings, at least not yet. The only part of creation you and I can perceive with our senses and know is there is matter, things that are made of atoms. Do you know what percentage of our physical reality consists of atoms, stuff that we can perceive? 5%. Think about that. As scientists measure the energy and the physical cosmos that is around us, their conclusion, their approximation is that only 5% of the physical reality that surrounds us is perceptible to us. 72% is dark energy. 23% is dark matter. That means 95% of the reality that surrounds us is imperceptible to us. That blows my mind. And apparently, what is true of physical reality that surrounds us is equally true of the spiritual reality that surrounds us, which brings us to our next great Bible story. 2 Kings chapter 6. The prophet Elisha, Israel's great prophet Elisha, is on the run from the king of Aram, Israel's arch enemy, because Elisha has been using his prophetic powers to tell the king of Israel what the king of Aram is going to do before he even does it. So the king of Aram is determined to capture and execute Elisha. The king of Aram is tipped off that Elisha is hiding out in a remote village. And so the king of Aram sends a brigade of soldiers to surround that village so that the next morning when Elisha and his servant awaken and walk outside the home where they're staying, they stop in their tracks and the servant has one of those, oh, shoot, moments. Except with the delicacy of the King James English, it says that the servant says to his master Elisha, alas, master, what will we do? Elisha responds, do not be afraid, for there are more with us than there are with them. So you've got the picture, right? There are hundreds of enemy soldiers that have completely surrounded this village. There's Elisha and his servant and hundreds of enemy soldiers, and nobody else is in sight. But here is old man Elisha saying to his attendant, don't worry, there are more with us than there are with them. And the servant is dumbfounded. So Elisha lifts a prayer and says, God, please open the eyes of my servant so that he can see. And that's when the servant saw that the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Yes, they were completely surrounded by enemy forces, but those enemy forces in turn were completely surrounded by a host of angels from heaven who were there to deliver Elijah. It may look like I'm surrounded, but I'm surrounded by you. Let me tell you, you are never alone. Whatever grief you may be facing right now, whatever army is surrounding you, whatever failures are threatening to overwhelm you, whatever fears are haunting you, there are more with you than there are with them. You are not alone. The visible obstacles that you are facing in your life right now are 5% of your reality. The other 95% is God and God's power and the power of the risen Christ. I like those odds. In one of her books, Sandy Patty tells the true story of George and Sarah Clark, who in the late 1800s felt called to launch a ministry to support and help homeless alcoholics in their recovery process. And this was in Chicago, Illinois. And so George and Sarah purchased a lease on a building in Chicago that had been known as the Pacific Beer Garden, and they rechristened it the Pacific Garden Mission. That rescue center is now the longest continuing operating rescue mission in the United States. It still operates to this day. But it almost didn't make it. When the ministry was first getting off the ground, as it began to thrive and grow, the expenses also began to thrive and grow and multiply, so that at one point, George and Sarah realized they weren't going to be able to meet the rent. They looked around for other sources of funding. They did everything they knew how, but they weren't finding additional sources of funding anywhere. They got down to the point where the next day their lease was up, and they were going to have to evict all of these homeless people that they had been helping, who were in their critical stages of their recovery process. So that night at home, George and Sarah got down on their knees and began praying and reminding God of all the lives that were being supported and lifted up by this ministry. God, you can't let us fail. God, you've got to make a way somehow. The next morning, they got dressed and ready to head out to close down the rescue mission. But when they walked out the front door, they stopped in their tracks and gasped, because their entire front lawn was covered with an odd white-like substance. It looked like manna had fallen from heaven, but it wasn't manna. Overnight, while they were on their knees praying, a bumper crop of some of the finest edible white mushrooms had sprouted in their front yard. They harvested the mushrooms, put them in a big cart, rolled the cart down Michigan Avenue to the famous Palmer House Hotel and Restaurant, sold the mushrooms to the chef, had enough to pay rent with plenty left over. Even when I can't see it, you're working. Even when I can't, you never stop. You never stop working. I tell you, we are surrounded by unseen spiritual power. And sometimes when that power breaks through and becomes visible, it can be dazzling. And it causes us to say, wow, I need me some of that power. Because God knows we've got needs, right? God knows there are all kinds of things that we need and we want. And so we find ourselves saying, how can I get me some of that power? A little boy named Jimmy was laying on a hillside in a meadow watching puffy white clouds as they were passing by one day, gazing up at the deep blue sky, the infinite sky. He began to have deep thoughts, and at one point he verbally said, God, are you really there? And to his amazement, he heard a voice echo back, yes, I'm here. How can I help you? Seeing an opportunity, Jimmy said, God, is it really true what they say, that 1,000,000 years to us is like a minute to you? Yes, God says, this is true. Jimmy says, and God, is it true what they say? That $1 million to us is like a penny to you? Yes, this is true. Jimmy says, God, could I have one of those pennies? God says, sure, in a minute. A minute is 1 million years. Rats, foiled again. When we hear that we are surrounded by spiritual power, we're like Jimmy. It's like, how do I get me some of that? How do I gain a measure of control over that power? Which brings us to our third great Bible story. I know you know this one. Exodus chapter 3. Moses is in the wilderness tending his sheep. When he looks up, and off at a distance, he sees a bush that is on fire. The amazing thing, though, is the fire is not consuming the bush. It just keeps burning and burning. And so Moses draws closer to investigate. And then he hears a voice from the bush that says to him, Moses, Moses, take off your shoes. You're standing on holy ground. The voice says to Moses, I am the God of your ancestors, Abraham, Jacob, and Isaac. And I am calling you to go back to your people in slavery in Egypt, to lead their liberation struggle. Tell them that I sent you. To which Moses responds, they're going to ask me, who sent you? What's the name of the God that sent you? So Moses asks the voice in the bush, what is your name? Now, that sounds to us like an innocent enough request. Until we learn that historians tell us that ancient people commonly believed that if you could discover the personal name of a god, you could use that name to gain leverage over that god, because you could then publicly invoke the name of that god, asking for something that you want, and if that god, so named, did not come through for you, that god would be shamed and his reputation would be diminished. So ancient people believed if you could discover the personal name of a god, you could exercise a measure of control over that god. So now when Moses says, what is your name? The question doesn't sound so innocent anymore. Moses, a creature of his culture, saw an opportunity to maybe get a little bit of control over the great power of this great God that was speaking to him from the bush. So when Moses says to this God, what is your name? That's when we get this famous response. God says to him, Exodus 3:14, I am who I am. Thus you shall say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you. In other words, God was saying to Moses, Moses, we're not going to play that game. I'm not going to tell you. You don't need to know my name. What you need to know, all you need to know, is the one who is sending you back. Tell the people of Israel, the one who is, was, and is to come, sent me. Moses, you're not going to gain control over me. Which, when you think about it, is a good thing. Can you imagine if we could gain control? If we could harness the power of God, can you imagine the mess that we would make? All the conflicting demands and things, you know, I want this and you want this. One day, three co-workers, a manager, her administrative assistant, and a sales rep from her department, all went to lunch together. They sat down in a corner booth and discovered that somebody had inadvertently left behind what looked like an old oil lamp. They started joking about how maybe there was a genie inside. So the manager rubbed it. And oh my goodness, a puff of smoke, and the genie appeared to them. The genie said, I hereby grant you 3 wishes. Since there are 3 of you, each of you will be given 1 wish. The genie turns to the administrative assistant and says, what do you want? She said, I've always wanted to live on a villa on the coast in the Caribbean, a life of luxury. That's what I want. Very well, the genie says, poof, off she goes. Genie turns to the second person, the sales rep. And what is it that you want? The sales rep says, I want to be on a hammock on a beach in Mexico, someplace where it's always 5 o'clock, somewhere, margarita in hand, a life of relief. That's what I want. Poof, off he goes. Then the genie turns to the manager. All right, one wish left. What do you want? The manager says, I want those two back at their desk by 1 p.m. They're back. Can you imagine if our wish was God's command, the mess we would make and the chaos that we would be in? Do you remember a few weeks ago when I said, imagine if you could date anybody in the world that you wanted, except it can't be your spouse. Who would you want to date? And without a moment's hesitation, Kim called out, Janet Jackson! Not a moment's hesitation. Didn't even have to think about it. She'd obviously thought about this before. I'm just saying. Imagine if Kim's wish was God's command. Poor Janet Jackson would have to break up whatever relationship she's in now, and she'd be plopped down in Kim's house, which is very nice, but probably nothing like what Janet is used to living in. And poor Pastor Bambi. I mean, she'd be out on her own, right? Can you imagine the chaos that would ensue if our wish was God's command? Thankfully, according to Exodus 3, it does not work that way. God is not some genie in a bottle that can be manipulated by us. The one we serve is the great I Am, who is beyond control. We began this sermon with a question: how can we harness the power of God in our life? According to Exodus 3, the answer is apparently you can't. If that's your objective, if that's why you're seeking spirituality in life, so you can gain control over the power of God and get more of what you want, you're going to be sorely disappointed, because it's not about you. It's not about me. It's about something so much bigger than any one of us. If we want to live with resurrection power, the goal is not to control God's power, but rather to allow God's power to control you. Your job is not to tell God what to do. Your job, my job, is to get lost in the greatness and the goodness of God, and to let the power of God fill us, so that that power, God's power, flows out of us to accomplish God's purposes. You see, spiritual power is not meant to be controlled. It's meant to be channeled. Do you see the difference? In the Gospel of John, Jesus said, those who believe in me, out of their belly shall flow rivers of living water. I love that imagery. That verse hangs on my office, in my office here at the church. Those who believe in me, out of their belly shall flow rivers of living water. The imagery there is God's power flows into us and then flows out of us to accomplish God's purposes, so that we become channels of God's goodness and grace in this world. And when you look at it that way, I guess you could say that in the final analysis, there are only two kinds of Christians in this world. There are only two kinds of people of faith in this world: those who want to control God and those who want to be controlled by God. Which kind are you? There's a famous old saying that goes like this: those who serve God for money will end up serving the devil for better wages. God is not going to be manipulated by our personal preferences. Our job is to figure out which way God is going, which direction God's spiritual power and energy is flowing, and then go with the flow. Reinforce that flow. Be part of the flow. Jeff, does that mean you're saying that we should never ask God for what we want? I mean, doesn't the Bible itself say, ask and you will receive? Doesn't the Bible say that God delights in giving good gifts to God's children? Yes. But the same Bible also says, James 4:1, you ask and receive not because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your pleasures. My prayers will have power only to the extent they are aligned with God's purposes. But Jeff, what if in some given situation, I don't know what God wants to happen? How then should I pray? Pray the way Jesus did. Which brings us to our final great Bible story. Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus knew what was coming the next day. He had already foretold it. And under the stress of the anticipation of what the next day would bring, there in the Garden of Gethsemane, he sweat, as it were, great drops of blood. And he then prayed this famous prayer, Matthew 26:47, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup of suffering pass from me. Yet not what I want, but what you want. You see what Jesus is doing there? Jesus knew and had already foretold to his disciples that it was going to be necessary for the Messiah to suffer in order to enter into his glory. But Jesus was also human. And the human part of Jesus couldn't help but hoping against hope that maybe there could be some other way to accomplish his mission. And so Jesus, from that human part of him, prays a very human prayer. He tells God exactly what he wants and hopes will happen. God, please, can't there be some other way? But he doesn't stop there. He goes on to add, yet not what I want, but what you want. In other words, he was saying, I've told you what I want. But if what I want is not what you want, what I really want is what you want. Because I trust your plan more than mine. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. What was about to happen seemed like an incredible tragedy. Certainly to Cleopas and that other disciple, to all of the disciples who witnessed it, Golgotha was the darkest possible day. On that Palm Sunday a few days before, when Jesus was received as king, their dreams were coming true. Their dream, their vision was, what they were asking God to do was to make Jesus the great earthly king that would establish Israel in a peaceable kingdom. That was their prayer. That's what they were asking God for. That's what they were hoping for in their humanness. But then comes the cross of Calvary, and everything is lost as Jesus is hanging on the cross. Great darkness descends over the earth. My God, why have you forsaken us? Where are you, God? The answer is that God was right there in the midst of the cross, whether they could perceive it or not. In their deepest tragedy, in their deepest grief, God was there. There's a painting that hangs in the London Museum. I forget the artist. It's the painting, when you first see it, until your eyes adjust to it, it just looks like a black canvas. But as your eyes adjust, you begin to see that Jesus is on the cross in agony. And as your eyes continue adjusting, you begin to see that in the dark storm clouds above the cross, there is etched the face of someone who is weeping, God. And God's arms are reaching down and holding Jesus up on the cross. Where was God during Calvary? right there, whether the disciples perceive it or not. You see, the disciples wanted Jesus to be their earthly king. God had a bigger plan. God wanted Jesus to become our cosmic king. But for that to happen, Jesus had to conquer death. Jesus had to surrender and trust God's plan. Jesus had to trust that God's power would be with him even through the valley of the shadow of death and raise him back up again. And that's what happened. God raised him up, not earthly king, but Lord of lords and King of kings. God's plan was better. Even when I can't see it, you're working. Even when I can't feel it, you're working. You never stop. You never stop working. Open your eyes. It may look like I'm surrounded, but I'm surrounded by you. Surrender. Trust. That's how we live with resurrection power. Let me close with this. Back in 1954, Reader's Digest published a story written by Reverend Howard Shade, a story about a young preacher and his wife who were called to an old, dilapidated church to minister there. It's not clear whether this story is autobiographical for Shade or whether he's talking about someone else he knew. But he tells about a young pastor and his wife who were called to a church that once flourished and thrived but had fallen into disrepair because the neighborhood surrounding it had fallen into poverty. And so this young couple are called to minister in this dilapidated church, and when they arrive, they are determined to make the sanctuary presentable again. So they spend months with hammer, paint, faith, sprucing up the sanctuary, getting it ready. They finished their project just a few days before Christmas. But as fate would have it that night, a storm passed through, tons of rain, the roof leaked, part of the plaster on the wall right behind the altar in the sanctuary got soaked and fell off the wall, leaving a gaping hole right behind the altar just a few days before Christmas services were supposed to take place. The next morning, when the pastor and his wife saw what had happened, they were devastated. God, why is this happening to us? Where are you? All of this work, and now we've got this. But they were perceptive enough to say, "Thy will be done." The next day, they happened to be at an auction, and one of the items that was auctioned off was this long 15-foot banquet tablecloth. Ivory in color with big gold bands running through it. It occurred to them, hey, that would be the perfect size tapestry to hang on the wall behind the altar to cover the big hole in the wall. Plus, it was gold in color, so that would be a seasonal color. So they bid on it, and for $5.60, this was back in the early 50s, they got that tapestry, that tablecloth. Hung it up on the wall. It was perfect. It looked like they had planned it that way all along. The next day was Christmas Eve. That afternoon, the pastor noticed a woman who was standing out at the bus stop in front of the church. It was a freezing cold day. He knew the next bus wasn't going to be there for another 45 minutes, so he said to her, "If you want to come into the sanctuary and warm up, you're welcome to." As she came into the sanctuary and sat down, she started to share part of her story with the pastor, telling him how she and her husband had been born and raised in Europe, in Florence, in Brussels, and when the Nazis began rampaging across the continent, they had fled the Nazis. And in the chaos of fleeing, in a big crowd one day, she and her husband got separated. And she had never been able to find him again. After the war, she had heard that he probably died in a concentration camp. As she was sharing the story, there came a point where she stopped and noticed the tapestry on the wall. She said, you know, it's uncanny, but my husband once made for me, a tablecloth that looked just like that. We used it for our special occasions. She got up, she walked up, looked at it close, looked at the stitching. She said, Pastor, I don't know how it got here from Europe, but I think that's my tablecloth. The pastor said, then it's yours. You should have it. Go ahead, take it. No, no, she said. It's in an honored place now. It's doing what it should. You keep it. She needed to leave. They exchanged contact information. She went out, caught her bus. That night they held Christmas Eve service. Afterward, a visitor to the church walked up and said, Pastor, I couldn't help but notice that cloth that's hanging on the wall behind the altar. He says, it's the spitting image of a tablecloth I once made for my wife. The pastor about faints and tells the man about the story of the woman he had encountered that afternoon. The man's eyes get big. He grabs the pastor's arm. He's in shock. He says, are you kidding me? Do you know where she is? Can you take me to her? Yes, the pastor says. So they drive to her apartment, walk up several floors, knock on the door. And oh, what a reunion. When the pastor and his wife first saw that hole in the wall, it made no sense. Where are you, God? Thy will be done. God had a greater plan. Even when I can't see it, you're working. Even when I can't feel it, you're working. You never stop. You never stop working. We are surrounded by so much unseen spiritual power. To live with resurrection power, you have to dare to believe. You have to dare to believe. You have to surrender and trust that God's plans are better and go with the flow and know that you are never alone. We walk by faith, not by sight. Stop trying to control everything. Trust in the power of God's presence. Humbly seek to align yourself with the flow of God's Spirit in any situation. Then feel the power. Amen.